KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm excited to have on someone that I've wanted to have on the show for several years, and through no fault of hers, totally mine, in attempting to get logistics together and extend the invitation, I finally done it. And my guest today is Professor Ann Barton of Pace Law School, who is going to be on discussing an article that she has forthcoming in the Stanford Law and Policy Review called Copyright Law and the Commoditization of Sex. When I teach internet law, which I do, which I've taught every year since I started teaching, I will start off the discussion of at least internet law generally, and part of what I ultimately mention, even in my syllabus, is that you need to be comfortable with some topics that you don't normally discuss in law school. And the first one that I immediately mention is pornography, because as anyone who is familiar with technology, anyone indeed who uses the internet, whether you target such content or not, knows that pornography is a big business, and it's one of the largest revenue streams that exists in e-commerce generally. And as Anne's article points out, it's big business not just for your stereotype of entities involved in pornography, you know, made famous in movies like Boogie Nights. But mainstream companies are making quite a bit of revenue by selling pornography by way of anything from internet websites to the opportunity to rent such films in hotels. And so this is a business that has the patina of being a back alley and not a topic that you discuss in certain company to something which is actually very important to how the internet works. It has had an enormous influence on law and the rules associated with what content can move through the internet, and ultimately is a topic that needs to be discussed. And in Anne's article, Anne takes a very close look at how copyright law has allowed the pornography industry to make quite a bit of money, and she proposes some interesting changes in the law that would remove at least the copyright incentive from the creation of a variety of types of pornography that are either criminal, literally, and certainly morally reprehensible. Things like child pornography, which actually has copyright attached to it, other types of pornography that are on the fringe, not only of human thinking, but also, again, are criminal and morally reprehensible, all have with them a copyright attached to it. The question of enforcement of a copyright in such a situation, which in many of these situations would seem odd at minimum, is separate from the fact that the law allows that copyright to exist. So in our discussion, we are going to spend time thinking about what those laws are, or the copyright law in particular, how copyright law works in this context, where the problems lie in terms of the commoditization of sex, and where Anne proposes that we go. And so this is a topic, again, that I tell my internet law students is one that you have to be comfortable with if you're going to delve into internet law. And I mention it also to the listeners that we may touch on some issues and topics which make you uncomfortable. And so I mention it up front before you get into the discussion. By way of background, Professor Barteau joined Pace Law in 2011. She's starting there from the University of South Carolina School of Law. Anne is a prolific scholar. I've seen her speak at several conferences, and her work is always provocative but extremely thoughtful. And this coming year, she has an exciting opportunity where she is going to serve as a Fulbright scholar at Tanji University in Shanghai. Anne is joining us via Skype from her home. Anne, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Sure, happy to be here.
And I will thank you up front, because I know you're heading to China in a few days. I appreciate you taking the time before you start on that trip. I'll jump in first because I'm curious about it. Perhaps you could start off by telling the listeners what you're going to be doing in China over the next year.
Sure, I'm going to be, there's something called, there are different kinds of Fulbrights, and the one I'll be doing is a distinguished lectureship. I don't know about the distinguished part, but it's an opportunity for me to be in China for an academic year to teach. And I'm going to teach in China. Law is a law degree is an undergraduate degree, but many Chinese law schools also have a graduate school. So the students there would go through 4 years of law school as undergraduates, and then the ones that stick around to get an advanced degree, those are the students I'll be teaching. And I will be teaching them in English. I don't speak Mandarin, although that's one of my projects while I'm over there is to try to learn some Mandarin. But I'll be teaching in English, and the students have been studying English, most of them since grade school, but certainly all the way through law school. And the particular students I will have an ambition to work in multinational law firms so that their English and sort of a grasp of U.S. intellectual property law is something they really seek. And then some of them want to be law professors, so I'll actually be working with them on their scholarship also. Just, you know, the stuff that I know, the U.S. intellectual property law and some international constructs, you know, treaties and Berns and such, working with them in English. So I really look forward to that. I know we both know colleagues who've done Fulbrights before, and they rave about the experience. I know it's going to be challenging, but I think a lot of fun. And then my sort of long-term hope is with the connections that I make with other academics in China and soon-to-be academics, to bring that to Pace, that Pace Law School already actually has a lot of connections with China through their environmental law program, and to help extend that to the intellectual property law offerings. Because having spent time the last two summers in China teaching and lecturing just a few weeks each time, but, you know, seeing some of the country and meeting some of the people, it's clear to me what an important force China is in the world now and will continue to be in the future. So I think, you know, at least personally, I need to embrace that professionally. So this is part of that.
And it sounds like an exciting opportunity. And having grown up near Pace University at the law school, growing up in Austin with the law school being in White Plains, I think it's a wonderful opportunity for Pace as well. And next week, incidentally, in a slight two-stage China discussion, next week Professor Susan Shirk from UC San Diego is going to be on discussing the edited book that she's written, Changing Media, Changing China. So perhaps those are two people, or at least Susan, someone that might be able to put you in touch with, or at least listen to the show.
Let's jump in with
a question that I ask virtually all of my guests up front, which is the genesis of your interest in this topic. And perhaps I'll ask that question even more broadly, because you write heavily on the intersection between IP law and technology and feminist legal theory. So perhaps you could talk more broadly about the genesis of your interest in that convergence.
Sure. I think, like many women, I was a feminist kind of early on in life without even having a name for it. As a kid, I was the oldest of two daughters, and my mother is kind of non-traditional. She grew up on a farm and always liked, you know, outdoor things. Her hobby is woodworking. She likes sports. And I guess, you know, I don't want to blame her for making me weird, but, you know, she's a person who didn't wear makeup. She kept her hair short. She wore jeans. She didn't fit the mold. And she takes a lot of joy. She still does out of, you know, woodworking, sports, those kinds of things. But she also got a lot of pushback, you know, that I sort of witnessed growing up. And then I also, you know, just kind of bumped up against just roles that were expectations that people had. I'm old enough that Title IX was, you know, I was in middle school then. When I was in seventh grade, I was forced to take home economics and sew an apron, and I couldn't wait eighth grade. I was allowed to take metal shop as an option, and I did. I made a toolbox, and so did most of my classmates, actually. Sports, you know, I played sports at a very small high school, and the difference between, for example, I was on the tennis team. The boys had uniforms and rackets provided for them, and, you know, it was a real sport. We had nothing. We had to provide our own rackets. We didn't have uniforms. We just wore whatever we had. We had to buy our own balls. I mean, it was just the disparity between the women's and the men's teams. It's, you know, that was really, you know, it's kind of in-your-face discrimination. And for whatever reason, I was a person that sort of noticed that and wanted to speak out about that. And that kind of continued through college and law school, and then in practice. And then once I got to, you know, the point of my scholarship, The scholarship, I think with you, as with you also, I mean, what interested me was straight up copyright law, trademark law, patent law, internet law, all those things doctrinally and just policy generally. I mean, I think there are a lot of really interesting questions, and I've thought about them, I teach them, and I've tried to write about them, not just gender related. But feminist legal theory approaches the law with sort of the question, is there, what about the women? I mean, really, that's the, kind of the starting place, because almost every area of the law, you can sit back and see that that maybe there's a different effect on women, a different outcome for women, some different questions to ask. In some areas of the law, those questions are really profound and obvious. Like, for example, family law, the way that the law treats mothers versus fathers, or, you know, women who've stayed home as homemakers versus men who are the breadwinners, you know, in a divorce, or those sorts of questions, you can't miss them, right? I mean, you just can't miss the gender issue. It's and a lot of people wrote about them. Other areas of law, it's a little bit more subtle, although also profound and interesting. For example, tax law. One of my colleagues at Pace Law School, Bridget Crawford, is one of the first people to start, not the only, but one of a wave of tax scholars to sit back and look and see that there were profoundly different ways that tax laws were affecting women. But because on the face it seemed neutral, it wasn't like, you know, mothers versus fathers, that those issues hadn't really been discussed, unpacked, and in some cases noticed, you know, with men, when men were the only people sort of writing the articles or practicing the area of the law. So intellectual property, again, there are some, I think some of the issues were more subtle. So it's not like primary, you know, my primary interest was never just gender. But when you start writing about stuff and you see stuff and you think, wow, you know, not everybody really noticed this, maybe they should or paid attention to that. So I've had a lot of fun with that in teasing out some of the gender issues in intellectual property. At the same time, the feminists, you know, kind of disambiguated from intellectual property law, the feminism was always there. And so other feminist legal theorists who wrote about, you know, kind of more raging day-to-day gender issues were things that I always kept up in. And pornography was one of those issues. I'm not sure, I mean, pornography was never, you know, it wasn't something I really wrote about or was that interested in academically for a long time, but I think as a feminist, you know, just the culture and pornography as part of a culture that treats women differently than men was unavoidable. And I don't know, at some point you look around at what is being critiqued from a feminist standpoint, and I think one of the things that's very interesting and became kind of interesting to me is that you can put a lot of energy as a feminist into deconstructing just basic mainstream advertising. And I think there's a lot to work with there in the ways that women are portrayed, in the ways that women are marketed to. And like I said, there's a lot, you know, sociologically, there's a lot from different standpoints to critique about advertising and the way it enforces gender roles. And so I got kind of caught up in that. I found it very interesting and I think very important, different books and, you know, feminist theorists, popular feminist authors. And one day it kind of occurred to me that that there was a hole in the analysis, that a lot of the sort of critical feminist analysis that was being applied to advertising was really not being applied to pornography. And I wonder about that. Why is it that you will spend, or someone might spend, you know, just weeks deconstructing a McDonald's commercial and a whole industry, a multi-billion-dollar industry that also is extremely gendered, would not get discussed? And so for that reason, I just became sort of interested in why it was that smaller industry, you know, things that both in terms of money and size and cultural impact that seemed less significant than pornography were getting a lot of feminist attention and pornography was not. And that's when I kind of worked backwards. I graduated law school in 1990, and that was a time that many people will point to as the end or close to the end of the so-called porn wars in feminism. Because there was a kind of a divide in how feminists thought about porn, and there were a lot of debates about that. So I went back and I did a lot of reading, and I was really surprised by my own reaction, because I, throughout my life, politically and professionally, I always thought of myself as a good liberal and a person who was very, very much engaged in the project of keeping the First Amendment vibrant and, you know, free speech, and certainly that's how I always felt about things. So my sort of natural surface reaction to the porn wars was, of course, I'm on the free speech First Amendment side. And but, you know, as an academic, you do get the time and the freedom to read. And the more I read, the more I became kind of confused and perplexed about how the First Amendment interacted or should interact with pornography. So I got kind of drawn into the literature. And then as a little offshoot about that, a few years ago, I was at a conference. Actually, I needed to produce a symposium paper for a conference at Lewis and Clark about kind of the free flow of information generally and the intersection of copyright law and the free flow of information. And somehow, in my research or my thinking, it occurred to me that, you know, pornography is information, and there must be a copyright intersection with pornography, a fairly explicit one. And that's when that kind of got me started. And I wrote a short article talking about the intersection of pornography, just as one example. It wasn't at all the main part of the article, but that was when I, to write a short excerpt about that, that kind of piqued my interest. And then a few years later, I was asked to write another symposium article for a conference at Vanderbilt University about user-generated content. And I knew the other symposium participants, there were certain approaches, and I wanted to be a little, you know, not just say the same thing everybody else was saying or thinking about. And I thought, you know, pornography is just huge in user-generated content. And that raises a lot of questions. So I believe 2008, I actually published an article when I talked about the intersection of pornography and user-generated content and the role that copyright law would have in all that. And again, I the focus there was user-generated content, but again, the more underlying fundamental intersection of copyright and pornography was a little bit a part of that. And so this is the third, kind of my third and biggest approach, where I just wanted to get down to brass tacks and just look at the intersection of sex and copyright straight up, what was written, what has happened in the courts, what hasn't been discussed, and try to pull that into an article, hopefully readable, that would bring those articles, some of those issues forward. And then from kind of looking at the issues, you know, I also have a prescriptive take on it, that copyright law currently needs to sort of maybe rethink its approach, possibly.
Now that gets us into the article a bit. And in order to do that, I think I'd like to ask for a couple of definitions. First, what do you mean by commoditization? How do you use that term? And in fact, what does it mean in the context of this discussion?
Sure. Okay, that's a great question. What it means, I mean, commoditization is taking sex and figuring out a way to monetize it, to sell it. And, I mean, there's the sort of obvious historical, sometimes called the world's oldest profession approach to that would be, you know, prostitution, the selling of sex straight up, you know, between two people. And then pornography is also a commoditization of sex. It takes something, you know, an expression of physicality, perhaps affection between two people, and makes it into something that is commoditized, that is commercially, you know, it's for sale. And if you step back and think, I mean, it's the same thing with music. I mean, there are a lot of people that you know, play the guitar, that sing, maybe in their living room or their basement. Maybe some of them write songs. In this age, so many people may put them up on YouTube, things like that, where it's just about sharing and having fun. And then at a certain point, maybe that person or certainly other people seek to commoditize that. That's not a hobby anymore. Now it's something I want to get money from. And how do you do that? Well, you need a copyright so that other people can't just take your song without your permission and exploit it commercially, that you've sort of got the reins over that, at least to the degree that copyright law facilitates. And then maybe you come get together with a recording company if you're going to record, or a music, you know, composer as a composer to get someone to distribute the sheet music, or however it is, to shop your song around to performers who might commercialize it, and you're trying to turn your song, your hobby, your talent into money. The same thing happens in pornography, that people, you know, that you have people who, again, take a physical act and then seek to make money from filming people engaging in the act, and then just taking in something that might be sort of casual and turning it into basically a commodity. And that's what pornography does for sex. It makes a visual commoditization, generally visual. That's what I'm concerned with, at least in the paper, of that. And then, you know, something that people buy and sell.
with regard to copyright, and we're chatting with Professor Ann Bartow of Pace Law School on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture, how does copyright enter into the equation? And really, that is I'm asking at a very basic level. We certainly discuss copyright on the show frequently, but in terms of copyright on pornography, how does that occur? Are people, for example, going to the copyright office and registering pornography, and then, of course, it'll get us in a moment to the, like I said, the more harmful pornography, as you define it, and certainly the idea that the pornography you're discussing in the article is harmful is not debatable, but the question is how it plays out. So how does copyright work in the context of pornography?
Okay, well, there are actually two different things I want to talk about there. The first, actually, let me start with your question, then I'll move it back a little. So, yes, that companies that that people who produce pornography, just like any other audiovisual work, in other words, just like a television program or a mainstream television program, a mainstream movie that you might see on regular, you know, over-the-air television during prime time, absolutely register the copyrights in their works, and the Copyright Office treats it like any other work. They don't, in terms of, you know, making any kind of inquiry or anything into questions that we might ask specifically about pornography in other cultural contexts, they don't ask at all. This was not always the case. And in fact, this is one of the things I found really, really interesting, which was up until the 1970s, I mean, pornography has always been with us and always will be, but up until the 1970s, the pornography was not viewed as being copyrightable. This was actually up until 1979. So you had a pretty, I guess the one word would be vibrant. You had a through the 1960s especially, but through all time, but through the 60s and early 70s to mid-70s, there was a lot of pornography that was produced, but it was just through sort of a general societal belief that it was not eligible for copyright protection because it was something else, whatever it was. And so there was no real effort to take advantage of copyright protection. And in fact, a lot of it was, there was a big influence of organized crime in pornography. And for whatever reason, there were two brothers that are kind of well-known, were well-known pornographers in the San Francisco area, the Mitchell brothers, and they produced, among other things, a film called Behind the Green Door. Is it Beyond the Green Door? I'm not even sure, but it was a fairly popular and well-known early work of pornography that was widely commercially distributed, and they decided to attempt to deal with the fact that they would make these movies and then other people would just copy them and distribute them and make money, and that the money wouldn't get back to the Mitchell brothers, by asserting copyright protection for this movie. So they did, and there was some pushback, but ultimately in 1979 they had engaged attorneys in a case called Mitchell Brothers Film Group versus Cinema Adult Theater, the Fifth Circuit, looked at the issue and said, basically dispensed with the objection that quote-unquote obscene material shouldn't be eligible for copyright, and said, well, we looked at the Copyright Act that was in effect when the movie was made, of 1909, and we don't see any problem with copyrighting it, that there's nothing in the Copyright Act that says obscenity or makes that sort of content-based determination is in any way a barrier to copyright. So basically at that point, 1979, the Fifth Circuit just completely flipped what had been a pretty commonplace societal understanding that pornography wasn't eligible for copyright, and said, yes, it is. Yes, it is. And the Mitchell brothers and every other pornographer in their way could then go ahead, and did in fact go ahead, and register copyright for their works. And that was one of the big building blocks to mainstream expansion and distribution of copyright. Because now you didn't just have actors like the Mitchell brothers making pornography and explaining it and having to deal with, you know, maybe organized crime and which theaters are going to go to and what the charges were going to be. Now you could have mainstream companies, maybe like Playboy, but also like just any mainstream movie company that could treat the work of pornography like they treated all their other works, which is, let's get it a copyright registration, let's get it into theaters, let's get it on HBO or satellite or whatever. And so it just really, really ramped up the sort of corporate approval, the corporate acceptability and corporate approval of pornography.
Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8 of the Constitution is the clause in the Constitution that gives the power to create at least copyrights and patents. And in your article, you start with this core of intellectual property law in the United States and question how it's been interpreted. So tell us a little about that. Again, for those aren't familiar, what is the text of the clause?
Oh, okay. I'm gonna have to find
I can help you with that. So you know we have.
Okay, why don't you read it? Otherwise, I'll have to put.
Yeah, sure. So the idea is right that the clause says that we are promoting right science and the useful arts. Which is the key phrase, it seems to me, in questioning whether, in fact, we should interpret the language correctly or whether we are interpreting it correctly, and if not, how should we put it differently? So in terms of that clause, what is your fundamental critique of it?
Oh, sure. Okay. So, yeah, and I think most of your listeners are pretty astute, but just this comes out of the part of the Constitution that explains what powers Congress has, right? What legislative powers Congress has, and it enumerates the powers that Congress has, and then one of the powers it says is promoting science and the useful arts, which was understood at the time and has always been understood consistently since then as being the intellectual property clause of the Constitution, that the idea that we would have a patent system and a copyright system, at least trademark to be determined later, but those two systems would be part of the new country. So the founders and the drafters of the Constitution expressly said that Congress would have this power to come up with and legislate around a patent system and a copyright system. Now, the text, as you point out, has two words. It's copyright's in there somewhere, even though the word's not mentioned, and patent's in there somewhere, although the word isn't mentioned. But one of the sort of fun things about legal scholarship is that there is some disagreement about whether useful and progress, which one applies to copyright and which one applies to patent, that there's actually some debate about how we situate copyright or patent in there. And that's a fun thing. It's because everyone agrees they're both in there. I don't know, it's like die or life and death, but people have made some pretty persuasive and interesting historical arguments. But the bottom line is the word useful is in there and the word progress is in there, and it's clear that both the copyright and the patent system are only supposed to apply to things that are sort of useful and progressive, not in a political sense, but maybe in a partly political sense of moving things forward, that bad things, it only applies to good things, positive things for society. So a lot of people, I don't actually spend a whole lot of time on that issue except to note that, I mean, people disagree what the margins are, what that means, but I think that it's pretty clear that's what the founders meant, and that's what Congress' congressional mandate is. So when the Fifth Circuit and Mitchell brothers said, well, I don't see any problem in the text of the Copyright Act, that may have been true, but there was an implicit understanding going back to the IP clause that what it meant was, at least against a framework, of only good things. Now, not good with a huge advance, certainly never being necessary, but positive things. Now, there's a little pushback, not really so much in patent law, although there's I talk about that in the paper too. In copyright, we never mean, and we never should mean, is qualitative in the sense of, is this good art, right? I mean, if you read a book and say, oh, that's just a terrible book, it's a stinker, it's poorly written, that book still gets copyrighted, and nobody really questions that because you have a subjective judgment that this is a good book or a bad book in the sense of whether you enjoyed it or not. Should never be part of whether we give it a copyright or not. And I think that's very clear. I completely agree with that. And courts have mostly, any judge that says otherwise or does otherwise is just wrong. I mean, that's very important. But there are certainly been cases, not a lot, but some cases in both copyright or patent where you have to question whether something is useful or progressive and whether giving it copyright protection really advances things. A lot of times in copyright that plays out, sometimes actually around computer software and how kind of useful it is, you know, in terms of copyrighting things and whether something, you know, is usefully copyrighted, whether that's something that leads to progress or things like that. In the patent sphere, you know, things that were deceptive or harmful, sometimes there were questions that were asked. A really important distinction in the patent sphere, you have a lot of people that get involved in deciding whether a patent issues whose mission is different than a judge. So you have patent examiners, you have the people, all the people in the patent and trademark office. Before you get into a courtroom, most patents are decided by people, by patent examiners or the patent, you know, people kind of up the food chain in the patent office. And they used to make decisions about whether something was good or bad and therefore patent worthy. They were using subjective value judgments, and there was no real review on that. It was very personal to them. And for example, sometimes inventions for sexual enjoyment were actually denied patents because there was something unseemly about the idea of patenting those things. And I think very reasonably there was pushback. Why are these unelected, unreviewable, you know, things that are unreviewable in sort of normal jurisprudential terms, why are these people able to make these decisions? And I think the decision was they shouldn't was a good one. And in fact, if there's something that we as a society decide shouldn't be in circulation, shouldn't be produced in circulation, that the way to address that is in the legal system, right? That Congress, that the it could be a federal law or a state law saying XYZ invention cannot be made and cannot be distributed. And then, of course, that's reviewable by the courts, as it should be. In the copyright context, we're in the courts, so it's a kind of a whole different thing. That if there's a question about, for example, the way copyright law is applied, or if it if it conflicts with the First Amendment, that's all in the court system. So some of the worries I think that we had legitimately about having patent examiners make these sorts of calls don't apply as readily in the copyright area, because our solution to the patent system was to kick it to the courts, and in copyright, it's almost always in the courts to begin with.
We're chatting with Professor Ann Bartow of Pace Law School on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope you continue to listen to KZSU as well as Hearsay Culture. Now, and in the article, you draw a distinction, I think, between what I'll call mainstream pornography, but the kind of pornography that one would go to the copyright office and get a copyright on, and what you call harmful pornography, which again gets at this problem that you've identified, or at least arguable problem that you've identified in copyright law with regard to what we do with this language about progress and usefulness. So perhaps, again, for listeners that aren't familiar, this harmful pornography is pretty reprehensible stuff. And can you describe what it is?
Well, the distinction I draw is actually not a content-based distinction. You're absolutely right, I talk about harmful porn, but the harm is there may be some differences in content, but it's not a content-based focus. My exclusive focus actually is on production, the production of the pornography, because my concern, and the concern that I try to address with sort of the prescriptive normative component of the paper, is that it's during the production that a lot of pornography, that a lot of harm is done. And some of that harm extends to distribution, but the distribution harm is still on the people who are in the porn. I'm not in any way, in any sense in this paper, talking about the effects on viewers of the porn. That is completely not a part of this paper, this analysis. But my concern is the production, but sometimes the distribution is a harm. So let me explain that. The kinds of pornography that I talk about are child pornography, which I think everyone there's a pretty broad societal belief, I think, understanding or support for the idea that child pornography is a very bad thing. Although, oddly enough, it is eligible for copyright protection. I don't think too many people attempt to register or enforce the copyrights in child pornography, but in fact it is oddly eligible for copyright protection, which I think is wrong. I think is an expressive matter, even though copyright's not being used a lot in that category of work, that the law is an expressive matter. Copyright law should declaim and say child pornography, because it is harmful to children and widely understood that way, should not be eligible for copyright protection. A second category is called crush pornography, and that is a genre of pornography in which animals, usually baby animals, are treated abusively. I think that's probably all I want to say about that. But the content, you can view the crush pornography. It has been litigated up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court held that it is not something that can be addressed through animal cruelty laws. That would violate the First Amendment, that whatever else is going on, the First Amendment protects crush pornography, which, you know, that's been asked and answered. I don't actually question that. But whether when animals are clearly being abused in the production of the film, we should be giving it copyright protection, again, is a normative and expressive matter, I think is very problematic. So those two, you can actually, you know, make they're content-based, but the concern is the children in the pornography, both when the pornography is made and the bad effect it may have them later when it's, just, even if they're adults later when it's still in distribution, and the crush pornography, which, you know, animals may not know that they're being featured in porn, but but they are treated abusively, and that in and of itself is a bad thing. The other two categories are not categories where you're necessarily going to watch the porn and be aware of the problem. The problem isn't what's in the porn, but how it was made. And those two categories are revenge pornography and works in which performers have been coerced, physically abused, or endangered. And both those categories, for example, the revenge pornography might be a case where it's a consensual sex and a consensual filming, but the idea of both parties is that that is just for the consumption of the two people in that relationship. Maybe there's a bad breakup, and one person decides, and it doesn't have to be, but in fact, it usually is the male decides to distribute the pornography to sort of show the world what a slut the woman is, or something about her, to degrade her and make her life uncomfortable, decides to distribute it on the internet. So during the production of the porn, there was not a problem, but the distribution was not something, even though the person, maybe it was the man, we'll just say, who decided to do the filming and therefore holds the copyright, the female in the case, never, her understanding was never going to be, this is commercially distributed or widely distributed porn, so she's victimized by that. So I think that's a problem, even though when you watch the porn, it looks like two happy people, you know, happy with what they're doing, because at the time of the filming it was, the expectation was very different for the party, so that has a very detrimental effect. And it could be that both people actually wanted to keep it quiet and a third party distributed. But, you know, there are different permutations of that, but the idea that copyright law, that you can copyright and economically exploit with using copyright law, revenge porn, I think is very problematic. And then the final category, you cannot always tell. Sometimes you can tell, but you can't always tell. But some works of pornography have a lot of violence. And some of that may be staged, and some of that may be consensual, but some of it clearly is not. And it's clear that it's not, for there's various evidence that it isn't. But for a variety of reasons, the police and law enforcement usually will not get involved. And people don't believe people that have the claims of violence. For whatever, there are a lot of complicated reasons. These people are victimized during the production of the porn, and they're also victimized later when the porn is distributed. There's a classic example of this, although people will call this poor woman, this woman is dead already, but we'll call her a liar, I guess, very emphatically. But the woman who performed as Linda Lovelace in a movie, a pretty famous old porn movie called Deep Throat. She, and I heard her speak, this was actually many years ago, but I heard her speak, and she said, you know, there was a gun, I was beaten. I did not want to be in that movie, but I was beaten. There was violence toward me. There were guns on the set. I was in fear for my life, so I did what I was told. And no one wants to believe that, and everyone wants to think I was so happy and enjoying myself during that movie. I didn't get any money for that. I didn't want to be in it. I didn't get any money, and it's just horrifying to me that this movie, you know, my children have to see this movie and know about this movie the rest of my life. This movie follows me, and I feel abused every time, you know, there's a reference to this movie. So she said very poignantly, and I was not a person who hadn't watched a lot of pornography. She said, you know, if you don't believe, people say I'm a liar. If you don't believe me, if you go back and watch Deep Throat, you can see the bruises on my body. And by gosh, I did. And you could. I mean, that woman had been beaten. So, you know, why are we allowing a copyright? Why are we using copyright law to facilitate the economic exploitation of people that have been abused? So I find that very problematic. Again, if you hadn't heard her speak, you could watch that movie. If you didn't notice the bruises or wanted to pretend they were makeup, from watching the movie, you would have no idea, but the people involved in the movie know.
You know, there's a distinction here. I mean, all of these four categories they identified all have various degrees of moral reprehensibility, and as I've mentioned, several certainly child pornography and crush pornography are appropriately dealt with in criminal law.
Right.
But that gets to the work that copyright is doing in promoting these forms of pornography, and that gets to the question and the fundamentals of copyright law, the idea of the utilitarian bargain, right? That we give that property right because we want to encourage the creation of these works. With regard to, and I'll separate them, although perhaps you'll tell me it isn't proper to do so. If I put child and crush pornography on one side, and revenge porn, and the works where as you've just mentioned, where actors have been coerced, abused, or endangered in another, and focus first on child and crush pornography, is it your contention that copyright law is actually encouraging the creation of these works? And if it isn't, then my question is, what would we stand to gain from eliminating copyright protection in those contexts?
Well, the child pornography probably does not have a pragmatic effect, but I think that I do think, and some people have written a lot more eloquently than I ever could about the expressive value of law, that there are some things that you make illegal because you're just expressing that this is reprehensible. So to just amend copyright law to say child pornography is not only illegal and under a whole bunch of other statutes, but under copyright law, we're just making clear that this is not something that copyright, that the intellectual property clause of the Constitution or the copyright legislation encourages. So there's that. Now, I also want to add, too, that, you know, it's not such a given. Child pornography, up until it was like fairly, I can't without looking tell you the exact year, but I think it was up until the 1970s, it was not illegal. So copyright law may have had a more meaningful, again, pornography generally didn't take a lot of advantage of copyright law then, but when it was first, when the first laws were passed, the age of consent was 16, and then later it was raised to 18. So, you know, some of these things are fairly surprisingly malleable. And it may be that at some point the ages get pushed down. You know, the kids in some jurisdictions, I believe, can still get married at age 14. And the argument has been made with a straight face that they should be able to be in pornography at age 14 as well, because teen porn is one of the most popular genres. So I think there's an expressive value to doing it today in today's environment, but I also think that we don't know what'll change in the future, and that for the government to, you know, more openly say, you know, embed in copyright law the concern about child pornography is a useful thing. The crush pornography, actually, there has been, because, as I said, the Supreme Court and every, you know, bunch of lower courts in the Supreme Court all affirmed the legality under, you know, the First Amendment values that are that protect crush pornography. Yes, that in fact copyright has more than that's more than expressive. That in fact copyright adheres and has been exploited in the context of crush pornography. So to the extent copyright incentivizes anything, and it must, I'd assume at least some of the time, even though, you know, being empirical about it's a little tricky in every context, movies, music, and porn. That that it actually has a meaningful role in crush pornography. In the second two categories, it has a huge effect. And in fact, I think the sort of copyright critiquing community, some of the public interest organizations, have only recently been paying attention to the fact. It used to be the recording industry were the bad actors in terms of copyright, being very, very aggressive, some would say very hyper-aggressive and inappropriately aggressive about enforcing their copyrights. Maybe the movie industry recently has taken some criticism for that too. But it turns out that pornographers fairly recently, but quite aggressively, have been very, very aggressive about enforcing their copyrights as well. And they actually have a hammer that the music industry and the movie industries lack, that they've been using for their own financial benefit. And this whole scenario doesn't work without copyright law. And that's this. What they do is when they detect illegal downloading, they send down. If you would download, say, a song, I don't know, just a what is a band that people like to make fun of? Nickelback. If you illegally download, quote unquote, you make an unauthorized download of songs of Nickelback, and then you get a Bigfoot letter saying, you know, pay up or we're going to sue you. Well, you decide what you're going to do, but I don't think you may not want to be exposed as an unauthorized downloader, but I don't think any of you worry too much about the fact that people are going to make fun of you for listening to Nickelback. I mean, you know, that's just kind of a jokey thing.
Right.
It's very different in the context of pornography. So what happens is somebody's an illegal, illegal, an unauthorized downloader of pornography, and the pornographers, the people holding the copyright, send a Bigfoot letter that says, we are going to sue you for copyright infringement, and in the context of suing you for copyright infringement, we are going to, you know, issue a press release that you have been downloading some works with pretty disgusting titles. So if you're a deacon in your church and the pornographer says, we're going to sue you for downloading disgusting sexual act, farm animals, disgusting act, you're going to pay up a lot sooner than you're going to pay up because you were illegally downloading Nickelback songs. Mm-hmm. So they have this hammer of trying to embarrass and humiliate and shame these people that they sue. So in consequence, cha-ching, right? The people that don't pay up or aren't quick to pay up or just pay small amounts when they're caught making unauthorized downloads of music or movies are writing pretty big checks to these pornographers, and copyright laws facilitating this.
And we have about, about 6 minutes left. Okay. And so this is the part of the show that I call the unfair portion of the show, where I ask questions that you can't answer adequately in the time we have left. And so I try to make them, even more pointed, and directed than throughout the show. So let me ask you this question. You mentioned earlier on how you view yourself as a good liberal, and throughout the article you talk about, your concern, with the positions taken by organizations like the Electronic, Frontier Foundation.
Right.
And so perhaps you could talk in the remaining few minutes before we close our discussion about your critique of EFF and other quote-unquote good liberals, as it were, with regard to these issues, and particularly the copyright issues associated.
Sure. I admire a lot of the work that's done, but I find that they are often driven by I want to back up and be very clear about something, that when you take the copyright protection away from something, that doesn't inhibit anybody's ability to speak. They can still make child porn, they can still make crush porn, they can still make revenge porn, they can still make coerced porn, you know, but unless other things make it illegal, which of course in some cases they do. But just taking copyright law away from something doesn't inhibit speech. All it does is take away the government's incentivizing of that speech. So I want to be real clear about that, because I do not view my critique or my proposal as interfering with anyone's ability to speak. Now, the sort of liberal copyright critiquing kind of EFF and others, the work that they do, again, is in most ways I support it, and I think it's very good. Where I really have been troubled, and not just in pornography, but I think that there are times when the First Amendment is not just it's too much a knee-jerk automatic answer without any real concern for the ways that people are hurt. That in other contexts, I think that a good liberal doesn't say, oh, here's an unsafe workplace, let's let people be free and do what they want. And you know what I mean? The libertarian answer is usually not the liberal answer. We say if people are endangered in the workplace, we don't just say, well, they can just work someplace else. We say, let's pass some health and safety legislation. Let's force employers to, you know, make the workplace more safe, things like that. As soon as you get to speech, suddenly good liberals become these extreme libertarians who don't even want to really think about or engage with some of the real harms that can happen. That the pornography, for example, is the production of pornography is an incredibly dangerous thing. A lot of physical abuse on the set, a lot of drug use, a lot of coercion, a lot of violence. And even really kind of mundane things, that there's an incredible that most pornographers refuse to let the pornographers take precautions for their safety. So STDs are spread, including fatal ones like HIV, are quite rampant in just what would be quote-unquote mainstream production of pornography. And there's a speech part of this, and a lot of liberals just do not want to engage with that they feel the values of freedom of expression are just so important that any criticism or any even suggested regulation just makes them crazy. and angry and want to silence people. It's sort of an irony that, you know, pornography seems sometimes a lot more acceptable than criticism of pornography, but, you know, that's also speech.
With regard to your proposal and what amounts to a categorical exclusion in copyright law, what's your sense of its viability as a proposal? I mean, certainly the idea that it would be hard for me to imagine, as I'm sure would any listener, a public official coming out and saying, well, you know, let's keep copyright protection for child pornography. In terms of having this proposal have legs, have you gotten any sense of it as a proposal that can move forward?
I don't know the answer to that. As you mentioned, the article hasn't even been published yet, and a lot of times people's objections, the things that they want to debate are the big picture stuff, so I haven't actually even talked a lot about the specific proposal. I don't actually, like you say, I don't think that anyone would think it was too problematic to just say child pornography is not eligible for copyright, thinking, well, might as well stick it in there, people aren't going to use copyright anyway. But as soon as you move to the other categories, it would get very contentious. I don't actually ask for a categorical exclusion of pornography. What I ask for is that the Copyright Office make a determination if there is harm. And if there's harm, they could ask a question of the person trying to register the copyright, saying, prove that there is no harm, or prove that this person in the film looks 14, prove that they're 18, then you can have the registration. It looks like these bunnies and kittens were treated badly, you know, something like that with the crush pornography, and then revenge or coercion. A Copyright Office, again, might look at a film and not see any coercion, so they would go ahead and register it, and that would not be the place at which this proposal became important. What would be important is if that pornographer tried to enforce the copyright in court, a defense to infringement would be this film was made with coercion and violence, and therefore is not eligible for copyright protection. So the idea is to kind of work back up the chain and incentivize pornographers to clean up their act and disincentivize, at least from a copyright standpoint, which isn't the only way to approach this, I realize, and might not be tremendously effective, but at least what it does, it says the government is not going to incentivize the harmful porn. So making those calls about which is the harmful porn definitely requires, you know, some administration and, you know, complicated questions, and sometimes people get them wrong. But that's not unique, right? That happens anytime we try to regulate anything. At the end of the day, for the government to stop incentivizing things like revenge porn, coerced porn, child porn, and crush porn, I think is an important value we can embed in copyright law.
You know, it seems, Anne, and again, unfair questions. I'll take 2 minutes, though. It would seem that a categorical exclusion, I mean, certainly, you know, you mentioned your example from the movie Deep Throat is an interesting one because it took examining the film to pick up on the fact that the actor's story had veracity. But with regard to, again, I use it as the extreme example, although all of these examples are reprehensible in their own way. It's a matter of degree, I suppose. But, it, you know, if you take something like like crush pornography, do you want and can the Copyright Office handle that kind of analysis? Because as you mentioned in the article, the Copyright Office doesn't do an analysis of whether something is good or worthy. They just give a copyright. If you're going to now ask the Copyright Office to do that kind of analysis as opposed to defining in the statute this is not copyrightable, are you concerned that ultimately becomes more problematic for the office and doesn't have the practical effect that you'd like?
That may be one. That category may be a category. If you put in the legislation in the Copyright Act that says, pornography, crush pornography in which animals were, you know, harmed, will not be eligible for copyright protection, then I don't think if it looks like so, then the Copyright Office gets a film where it looks like animals are harmed, then the pornographer can come back and say, this was not, you know, this was a stuffed animal, this was a robot, or we treated it safe, you know, come back and rebut that to get the registration. But the more important thing to me is that it disincentivizes. It's true that crush porn is still going to be made, but at least they know that if somebody infringingly downloads it and gives it to their friends, there's no copyright way to stop that, and so there's an economic disincentive for the crush porn. It may not be enough to stop the crush porn, but it's one thing the government's not doing is not helping the crush porn, you know, spread like they do when they enforce copyrights.
Professor Ann Bartow of Pace Law School, author of the article Copyright Law and the Commoditization of Sex, which is forthcoming in Stanford's Law and Policy Review. Thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture. I should mention we're recording the show on August 22nd. Ann, thank you for joining us today. I look forward to having you back on the show after you come back from China. We can discuss what you've learned there. Or I can even call you in China. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see how the schedule plays out over the course of the year, because that certainly would be enjoyable as well. But thank you for joining us on the show and for writing this article, and I appreciate you taking the time.
Sure, thank you.
I'm happy to mention one last guest coming up in this summer quarter of Hearsay Culture, and that is, as I mentioned beginning of the show, Professor Susan Shirk of UC San Diego, editor of the book Changing Media, Changing China. After which, KZSU will be in its interim schedule, and during the interim period, I do not record new shows. And so we will be running either repeats or simply there'll be other shows going during the schedule. We will pick up, however, in October. We will sort to, I guess, late September perhaps is when the new schedule picks up. And I'm excited to mention a number of guests that will be coming on in the fall quarter, including Professor Helen Nissenbaum of New York University discussing her book Privacy in Context, Andrew Renz, research associate at the Center for the Study of the Public Domain at Duke Law School, Professor Jennifer Urban, the director of the Samuelson Law, Technology, and Public Policy Clinic at UC Berkeley School of Law, Professor Dan Hunter of New York Law School, Professor Dan Solove of George Washington University Law School, author of Nothing to Hide, The False Trade-Off Between Privacy and Security, as well as Professor Lewis Hyde of Kenyon College, author of the book Common as Air. I'm also reaching out to other guests, so if you have any suggestions on guests that should be on the show or other feedback about the show, please email me at dave@hearsayculture.com. As always, you can listen to this show live on KZSU Wednesdays at 5 p.m. Pacific time, or you can get the show by podcast by going to Stanford Center for Internet Society's iTunes page, by going to our webpage as well at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all previous 140-odd shows as well as the upcoming schedule. Again, I welcome your comments, suggestions, feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Please stay tuned for more diverse programming, and have a great day.